Blog Talk Radio.
In the dead of night, when thy winter wounds shall not be healed from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone and you sit huddled by the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight? The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, caveat emptor, ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knott.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madam and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of Night Zone Radio. I'm your host, Colin Knight.
Tonight, a special taping live in the UK at 8 p.m. Monday evening UK time. Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone. Your host, Colin Knight.
It is Tuesday, July the 13th, 2010. Great big shout-out to the Southeast Bricklayers' better half. Yeah, come a long way since Tabor, kiddo. To Annie from Belfast, Northern Ireland, thank you for your email. Our blessings are with you. We hope for peace in Northern Ireland once again after last weekend's riots. And to everyone who emailed the show, we appreciate your feedback. Keep those emails coming. In response to a number of our listeners in the United Kingdom who can only hear us on download, unless of course they want to sit up till 3-4 a.m. for the live feed, we launched in the UK a live show at the 8 p.m. UK time slot on Monday evening on the Blog Talk Radio Network, also carried by UKNet. This Monday night slot will happen once a month in the UK as we bring guests from the United Kingdom into the North American market. And then, of course, we will rebroadcast their information up into the Night Zone North American system. If you're feeling industrious and want to tune into the live feed to the UK, it's at 3 p.m. Eastern Time in North America on Mondays once a month. And, of course, we'll advertise the dates. Our first guest was Andy Lloyd, author and ufologist. He brought us some interesting information on a number of subjects, and the conversation opened with discussions, of course, on the British weather patterns. Tell you what, let's take a listen.
Tonight, special taping live in the UK at 8 p.m. Monday evening UK time. Good evening, UKNet. Thanks for hosting our show tonight.
Our guest tonight, of course, is Andy Lloyd, author and ufologist. Welcome to the show, Andy. Glad you could make it tonight.
Thanks very much, Colin. Great to be on your show this evening.
Before we get to the body of the show, I'm hearing all kinds of reports of torrential rain in northern England, Andy, and southern England scorching from heat. So I hope everything's okay in your area.
Yeah, we've had quite a drought condition. I mean, British weather is never predictable, never predictable, as I'm sure you're very aware. And they have said down the years that if global warming is to be believed, and I've got an open mind on that, that will be the weather pattern of the future, that there will be wet times in the summer up north and very dry and more continental in the south. So what seems to have happened now is that London just bakes like Paris.
Right.
And London, you know, people associate London, they used to associate London with smog and fog, and now they've associated it with rain. And really speaking, it's become almost continental. It's a lot drier and a lot hotter in the summer than it used to be. And up north, they get all the rain. So they have floods up there and drought down here. And it's, for such a small island, it's quite a strange duality.
So you have noticed over the last, say, 10, 15 years, Andy, that these weather patterns have been changing?
Well, insofar as you can notice any pattern to the British climate at all, right, because it is so unpredictable. Here in Gloucester, where I lived 3 years ago, we had such torrential floods that the whole county almost got evacuated. And down the bottom of my road, there were canoeists cycling along the road. I mean, it was absolutely insane. And we had an incredible... And then this year, it's dry and drought-like, and it's a very unpredictable thing. But if global warming really does happen, and I do believe that there's a lot of solar stuff connected with it, as well as
right.
man-made things and things that's possibly connected with the dark star that we're going to talk about as well. If that's the case, then I'd prefer to be living in a northern climate where we are, you know,
right.
because if it heats up here, we'll be growing wine, the
yeah.
vineyards will be
yeah.
flourishing once again,
yeah.
and we'll be British wine will be the toast of the world.
And the British garden community would once again flourish. I mean, very exotic greenery, I would think.
Yeah. It's quite ironic that that Brits are one of the great worriers about global warming. We worry. We do the worrying for the world, the British.
Right.
But in actual fact, a warm climate here would actually benefit us. The
yeah.
amount of deaths during the winter would decrease, and would more than offset the amount of deaths during the summer from overheating. And we actually stand to benefit from it, except unless, of course, the seas rise. So the east of the country will be swallowed up. But
yeah.
apart from that minor detail, it's all good.
Yeah. Well, we are currently working on a Tesla special. And I got to tell you, we've uncovered some startling facts about governments around the world developing methods to affect the weather and the natural balance and ecosystem of countries. Has there been any whisper out there in the UK regarding weather manipulation at all?
Well, I guess we often hear about cloud busting and the kind of chemicals that go up into the air. And, of course, we on Cosmic Conspiracies have kept a close eye down the years on
right.
things like what's coming out of the back of the aeroplanes that seems
yeah.
to be forming cloud cover. And you know, when the volcanic eruption in that incredibly difficult to enunciate volcano
right.
in Iceland went off
right.
and blocked off earlier a few months ago, the thing that we all really noticed here is that we could go out into our gardens and look up in the sky, and we had blue skies,
wow.
and there was no cloud. And it's remarkable to see just how much of the cloud is created by these planes that come in and out of Heathrow Airport. It's
right.
remarkable. And to see blue skies, I think it must have been the first time for 40 years that anyone could see purely blue skies.
Funny you should mention that, because right after 9/11, when the North American skies were cleared of aeroplanes, there was a lot of reports regarding the atmospheric conditions that the skies were clear, that there were no clouds, there was no chemtrails, no nothing. Now, I have a scientist friend in the New York area who has continuously attempted to get me to look into chemtrails on aeroplanes, and the more we look into it, the more complicated it gets. And it's one of those issues that is so difficult to broadcast without looking at charts and maps and paper. You can't visually or you can't audially bring it to the public very easily. And it's a difficult thing to, you know, for people to get their head around that these chemtrails could be government organized. There could be a reasoning behind it. And my scientist friend in New York has a lot of theories as to what they are seeding the earth for. So what are they seeding the earth for? What are the chemtrails all about? Well, we will be looking at that in the fall, along with weather patterns, along with the Tesla project. So the weather, although unpredictable in England, is bringing its wrath on the countryside. As Andy said about the flooding, remember most of northern England, northeast England anyway, portions of Britain are below sea level. And flooding is a regular occurrence. And if the oceans do rise due to global warming, for whatever reason, who knows what the UK will look like in the near future. And as I said, in the fall, we have a special show on the weather manipulation using the Tesla projects. And of course, we're getting government denial from those projects, but we're going ahead with the show anyway. The weather patterns and chemtrails, two great shows are scheduled for this fall. So we do invite you to keep checking the listings as we start booking for the fall season. So let's listen to more of the Night Zone UK with guest Andy Lloyd, the author of The Dark Star, Planet X. We're going to talk about the Dark Star. Now, if I wander, you pull me back onto a point, and if you wander, I'll do the same thing. And maybe we can get through this, because it's a deep subject. We can go in a million directions with the Dark Star. Stories and prophecies somewhere out there in the vast universe is a planet that has affected Earth on a frequent basis. It continues its perpetual orbit around and through our system. Some people are calling it Nibiru, some call it Planet X, but tonight's show we'll call it the Dark Star. What's this all about, Andy?
I guess the idea of a missing planet is about as mythical as dragons and so on. I mean, it's an archetypal idea, really, and certainly in the world of science fiction. But like all really, really good myths, it could well actually have a very strong basis in fact. And if that is the case, I do believe it is, then the presence of the Dark Star at the edge of the solar system, very, very long way away, I have to say, but would actually solve a lot of problems in ufology and would solve a lot of the sort of reasons why people object to the ideas of, say, UFOs, because it provides an opportunity for life to exist in our solar system, allowing intelligent life to visit us from a relatively sort of nearby platform. That's habitable and yet unseen at this time. So that's one of the bases why I think there's a tremendous appeal to this. The second reason why there's a tremendous appeal to this is because this planet is thought to return and is spoken of in mythology, but also in quite a lot of the sort of scriptural texts and so on that people are obviously very interested in that have been passed down to us from ancient times. So it has a fairly deep-rooted appeal to us in the West, and where the myths of things like the flood and so on sort of grow around the world or extend around the world, right. it sort of pops up in all of those as well. So it's an exciting proposition, and as a sort of trained scientist, I have a sort of a vested interest in trying to prove the existence of this thing. Or to disprove the existence of the thing, in order to solve some of the tremendous mysteries that you and I and so many other people are fascinated in.
Now this Planet X, I discussed this matter with a number of experts, Marshall Masters, CNN science correspondent. He has a Planet X forecast website up there. And I've also talked with Mr. Shaw with the Torah Code and the incoming Nibiru, the planet. It's, like you say, the tie-ins, I think, give you pause for cause. It makes you want to know definitively if there is a dark star or if there is a planet incoming. Do we have any real scientific evidence showing any gravity variance or anything like that?
I'm sort of very acquainted with Marshall Masters because he and I used to work reasonably closely together with some of these particular points. And his interest is clearly in events that may occur around about the 2012-2013 time, which ties in with the Mayan calendar and the sort of prophecies that may come out of the end of the Mayan age around about that time. And my particular interest, of course, is in the science and in looking at evidence within the solar system which points to the existence of this body. So there are areas where our interests coalesce, and there are areas where we differ in our opinions. Yeah. My opinion is that the object remains a very distant object at this time and lies between the Kuiper Belt, which is a sort of second asteroid belt beyond Neptune, and the sort of inner Oort cloud, which is a cloud of comets much, much further out. And there's a sort of a gap between these two zones, which I believe is the sort of kingdom of this dark star. So it's a binary companion that's located at that distance. And there are a number of anomalies to do with the outer solar system, to do with the bodies in the outer solar system, and some of the forces that go on out there that indicate that things are not the way science currently describes them or would like to see them. Those anomalies point to the existence of something out there that they have yet to find. And in actual fact, at the moment, scientists are engaged in a very active exploration of that area using an infrared device known as WISE, and are hopeful, some of them are hopeful, the ones from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory anyway, are quite hopeful of discovering this object before 2013.
2013. Now that's there's the number. Is it 2012 to 2013, and it comes in two different ways if you start looking at it. This area of time. Now the area of time is the argument, and we've gone around this circle a number of times. But depending on which calendar. Now the Old Testament clearly was not written with the Julian calendar in mind, or the Roman Greco calendar, or even the Mayan calendar for that matter. The Old Testament was written upon a time that doesn't exist anymore. And now we are trying desperately to take those stories and fit them into time space that makes sense. And as Andy said, you're looking at 212, 213, somewhere in there that there, you know, this is going to happen. There will be changes upon our life. I don't think it's going to be catastrophe. I don't think we're going to be destroyed. I do think we're going to be tested.
The timing of that, to do with the end of the Mayan Age, it may not be that this planet sort of comes crashing our way,
right,
but the discovery of the existence of that body may actually coincide with the end of an age, and in a way create a new era of understanding about our origins and the nature of this solar system.
Yeah, we've talked extensively with John Hogue from Hogue Prophecies regarding the 2012 Mayan end and what's to come after 2012. And his explanation is that it is the end of an age, but it's the beginning of a new age of enlightenment. That it's a matter of knowing, not guessing, not wondering, but actually knowing. And our scientific experiments are going to come to fruition, and we are going to know what our history was, which I find is fascinating. Now, your book on the dark star, it's based on the planet X, on the scientific evidence. There's also a couple of twists and turns in the book, which I really don't want to explain outright, because I want people to pick up the book.
Yeah, I've kind of tried to attack this subject in two different ways. One of them is to produce a book, which is, as you say, The Dark Star, which is a sort of essentially a non-fiction book, in an alternative knowledge book, where I produce an alternative paradigm based upon anomalies and quirkiness that is otherwise ignored by science, and, you know, use that to try and explain things. Try and explain sort of the Ice Age eras and changes to our Earth, changes to our planet, and anomalies within the solar system to do with this body out there. Mm-hmm. So that's part of my work, and The Dark Star was published in 2005, and it's been very popular, and a lot of people consider that to be sort of a standard text now to do with Planet X.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the sort of Dan Brown tradition, I thought about that and thought, well, this obviously has an interest to researchers and has an interest to people who are very sort of clued into quite deep thinking, as you introduced the piece.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a very exciting idea from the point of view of the general public, if only they could access it in a very sort of an easier way to understand. So the last two books I've written, which is Ezekiel 1 and Followers of Horus, have been a sort of fictionalized way of understanding what's going on, and created a sort of Dan Brown type thriller to do with conspiracies,
right,
and a little bit of science fiction as well, and these quirky Anunnaki people described by Zechariah Sitchin. And I've thrown those into sort of a melting pot of ideas in order to make the Dark Star an understandable phenomenon. And it's been relatively successful because,
right,
you know, people who would otherwise not necessarily want to sit down and read a quite a heavy alternative knowledge science book,
mm-hmm,
can read a something good thriller and enjoy it, and still at the end of that and come away with a bunch of new ideas that sort of, you know,
exactly,
ruminate.
Yeah, it's important that, you know, a spoonful of sugar does help the medicine go down. And a lot of the information that comes out of scientific facts, if it was truly brought out in its cold terms, would probably scare the bejesus out of us, you know?
Yes, yes, so, I absolutely agree.
So I like the way you've done it, because you are still giving them the information, or enough information for them to actually use their intelligence.
I think at a format it works. It has its risks insofar as you run the risk of losing a certain amount of credibility because you start writing fiction. So people think, oh, well, it's just fiction. But really, it's an art form. It's a way of actually sort of taking these ideas and putting them out there. And part of the problem with writing non-fiction about things like the Anunnaki and Nibiru and so on is that you necessarily have to speculate, because those stories are wrapped up already within sort of ancient writings, and Zechariah Sitchin does an amazing job of bringing out the flesh and blood gods and the planet Ex Nibiru and describing them, but they're interpreted from texts written in ways that we don't normally describe. And so what I've done is to try and take those ideas and mixed in my own dark star ideas about the brown dwarf and so on, and put them into the modern world that we can all relate to, and try and understand what it would be like if those guys were still around, you know, if the Anunnaki were still here, if there was an alien presence on our world that was pulling the strings behind the national governments and the sort of New World Order.
Right.
And that is an idea that it lends itself to fantastic fiction, but sometimes if you try and put it through a non-fiction format, like, say, David Icke does, it just sounds too fantastic.
Yeah.
So it's a calculated risk, but I think it works.
The connection between the Anunnaki and the New World Order, or the Illuminati, or whatever else you want to call it, is quite interesting. We chased an article that we were thinking of doing a show some months ago, and we chased an article on the bloodline of the kings and queens of Europe. And the further we got into the bloodline, the more obvious it became that there are people, maybe nefarious or otherwise, who are controlling the destiny of man on Earth. Now, you could call it the New World Order, the Anunnaki. I don't know. But Andy managed to bring that query and tie it with the return of the Anunnaki and Planet X in a very bold way. And I must admit, I like the connection. Well, the three books, the way I see it, the Dark Star kind of lays out the evidence. Mm-hmm. And then Ezekiel 1, although it's fiction, it is based upon Planet X and 2012, the conspiracies. And then The Followers of Horus, where you introduce the Anunnaki to the mix, I think is the cream of the crop. It brings a lot of your research to bear. And again, in a medicine that is coated with enough sugar, and, you know, that people can digest it willingly.
And it's quite a dark book, The Followers, of course. I mean, I've only just had that published, so it's really only just starting to sort of settle into the consciousness of my readers, really. But the idea behind that book is to try and understand what the motivations would be of the Anunnaki now. I mean, take, for instance, the possibility that some of these ancient gods never left our world. Yeah, there was a film 20 years ago called Highlander, which had an immortal living amongst men. And a fascinating story, because he would obviously never age, but he would sort of take a wife, and his wife would then age in front of his eyes, and then she'd be gone. And those kind of ideas have kind of stuck with me. And so how would an Anunnaki go about his business in this world? It would be their natural inclination to just try and take over and be the head of a multinational company or the head of a nation. But after a short while, it would become clear that they didn't age compared to everyone else, and their true nature would be, be understood by people, and therefore they would be rejected as aliens and so on. So my whole sort of cunning approach to this is to try and see how they would survive amongst us in a dark, sort of shadowy way, pulling the string, being around, influencing things, making things happen, but never actually coming out into the light of the public's eye in a way that... That they would be exposed.
That they would be exposed as non-aging or as ancient ones, if you will.
Yeah, and in that way, they're essentially kind of the New World Order. You know, they're these
right.
characters behind the power, but they're still fighting because that's what they always did. Enlil, Enki, they were brothers. They fought each other in the sense of trying to dominate and try and have power, and their characteristics
right.
are very different. And I wanted to take those ideas, those very ancient, mythical ideas, And use those in this sort of modern context and create a sort of Sitchinite scenario in a Dan Brown sort of way.
Right.
So I hope I've succeeded with that. I think I've produced some quite exciting and interesting fiction. But whether it gets made into movies or whether it sort of takes off, only time will tell.
Exactly. But at the same time, the information is there. And if you pick away at the storyline, there's information there that has some very direct bearing on society, because you spoke, for instance, in Ezekiel 1, you used the reporter as the as kind of the cameraman, if you will.
Right.
And
yeah.
That really hit home, because you can imagine that reporter. It has a tangible body, if you will, and I think that's important when you're trying to bring the information that we bring regarding UFOs. And regarding the Anunnaki and all of these possibilities from ancient history, to bring them forward, you need to give them body. And I think you managed to do that, Andy. I truly do. And
I'm glad to hear you say that. I think it's fair to say that oftentimes with all of us, we live in our own sort of little world, which is of tremendous value, but an event is often required to open our eyes up to other possibilities and the broader context that we sort of swim around in, the ocean
right.
in which we swim. And if you can put yourself into a situation like a character in a book where you relate to them as a normal person
mm-hmm.
going about their daily business like you, and then suddenly they're confronted
exactly.
with these absolutely extraordinary events that are mind-blowing and have to deal with that and come to grips with it, then that's much easier than just sitting there in an auditorium and listening to a speaker trying
yeah.
to tell you that there's a new world paradigm that you've got to understand, and
yeah.
you think, well, that's fine, but how does that relate to my life?
Yeah,
and
I can relate to the method that you use, because now we do space flight, time travel, wormholes, dimensional shifts, ghosts, spirits. We do a number of things on the night zone, and at times it is difficult to get that vision out to the audience. For them to be able to pick up what we are seeing or what we see without giving them charts and video. Audio can be difficult when it comes to presenting a package, but your book has done just that, and it's packaged it in such a way that it's presentable, it's worth reading, and it has enough of a fictional twist to keep you interested in, well, I wonder how he got himself out of this one. You know? And there's a couple of reasons that we did the audio live into England. One, because of the market demographics. Clearly show that we need to be at their time to penetrate that market. But secondly, because we need to do it clandestinely. Because had we advertised this show and had we promoted the show, then we would have had all kinds of technical glitches. As it happens, we ran almost flawlessly. Now, some would say that's just the luck of the draw. Some would say that it's possible there's some kind of conspiracy there. Now, I don't know. I'm not the expert. I just bring the experts on air to give us those answers. Andy Lloyd, author, ufologist, part of the Cosmic Conspiracy Team out of the UK. What an impressive man. The Anunnaki, in your last book, The Followers of Horus, the Anunnaki, I wasn't quite sure, were they here dormant, or were they active, like you say, within the New World Order? Are these people that just perpetually in the shadows of power, do you think?
The characters that I have, the Enki character is a kind of a messianic character.
Right.
And in Sitchin, he relates the character Enki from ancient myths. He's a sort of a god of medicine, and he helped to sort of forge us in the image of the gods and brought forth humanity. And then when the flood occurred, which was an event that Sitchin thinks is triggered by a sort of a passing of this planet, Nibiru, the Dark Star, what have you, the Enki was the one who said, well, you know, actual fact, I think I want to save humanity. I don't want them destroyed. We'll you know, take Zeasudra or Utnapishtim or Noah, whoever he was, depending on which pantheon you're talking about,
right,
and we'll allow him to take his family and survive by building this sort of submarine ark thing. And so he has to be the good guy. I mean, he has to be the good guy. But in Ezekiel 1, I start by having him as this sort of shadowy tall man who is behind the scenes, and you don't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy, and he appears to be lurking in such a way he keeps popping up at all the wrong moments and the dangerous moments, and you think he might be behind the awful events that occur in that book. And then as we move through into the second book, The Followers, it becomes clear that he is actually someone who's actually trying to stop something awful happening. He believes that by sending this spaceship Ezekiel 1 to Nibiru, that there is a risk that the sort of wrath of the Anunnaki will be let loose, and that there'll be an invasion, and they'll come here, and that humanity, his little project, humanity, will be at risk. So he is attempting to sabotage the whole project. Now, his brother Enlil doesn't really play a part in the first book, but in the second book he comes forward, and he's essentially the mastermind behind the Ezekiel 1 black project.
Right.
And he, Enlil in Sitchin's books, is Yahweh. He's a sort of god. He's
right.
the main man. He's in charge of all the wars and the battles, and he's the guy, the jealous god, the guy you don't want to get upset.
Gotcha.
So, again, in the book, Mr. Lil, as I call him, Enlil, he's a sort of a cantankerous, jealous figure who is a control freak. He doesn't like the fact that the crew on the ship start doing things the way they want to do them. He gets upset, he gets cross, and he messes with them and he plays games with them, as I believe Yahweh does in the Bible. You know, he sort of messes with people and messes with their heads and tries to control them.
Right.
So I've tried to keep to that character again. And then the third character is in these books is Marduk, who's the Lord of Babylon, the God of Babylon. And he's a sort of a darker, macabre figure who is power mad, a megalomaniac, wants to control everything like Enlil, but is more powerful and is capable of sort of extending power over huge amounts of people and getting them to do what he wants. And he's like the really bad guy. He's the guy who's on the ship, and he is going to cause problems, because if and when he gets to Nibiru, we don't know what his... I haven't written what his motivation is, but it's clearly nefarious.
Right.
And he's like this very, very dark figure, not to be met with at all, really to be avoided. And then these poor people who are running the ship find themselves at his mercy.
Right.
So those are the three guys, and that's how I envisaged it. And as I was describing before, Enki was somebody who was around all the time, and like the guy from Highlander, would just pop up every so often to help. Lil is sort of someone who's just created a financial dominion, but is a very secretive New World Order figure.
Right.
And then Marduk, Sitchin has him as effectively someone who's died. You know, he's supposed to be dead, but in my book, he effectively comes back to life on his tomb and is,
right,
you know, resuscitated and brought back.
Right. Now, the references that you are making to these characters, this is from the book There Were Giants Upon the Earth by Zechariah Sitchin, right?
Yes, I mean, Sitchin's written, about 10 books, I suppose.
Yeah.
His first one being The 12th Planet back in 1976, and he's just released the book There Were Giants Upon the Earth. I suppose that the book that he's written that most encapsulates the history the Sumerian history of these gods is the Lost Book of Enki, which is a very odd book. He wrote it almost in the form of an ancient text that's been translated into English. And part of it fits in very well with the text that we know, and then other parts of it he's effectively sort of said, well, these are the lost bits that haven't been found, but in order to make the whole story cohesive and fit together, I've sort of made it up and plotted all this in.
And is there anybody out there? You know, it's a question that I guess man has been pondering for a very, very long time. Is there anybody out there? Are we alone? Well, if we are alone, if we are it in this universe, then I'd say we are in deep, deep, deep trouble. If we are the most intelligent thing out there, we've got some problems in River City. We don't know what to do with our garbage. Now, a question I asked a scientist some time ago, a couple of questions, and I never did get an answer, but I will get the answers. I promise you that. One question was, is there any more water on the Earth than there was a million years ago? That's the first question I'd like to know. Has the mass of water changed on the Earth in a million years? And the second question I want to know is, if we are traveling so darn fast throughout the universe, then by the time we realize Planet X is upon us, it's upon us. There's not much we can do. It's like crashing into a car at an intersection that you have absolutely no chance of stopping. It's being sideswiped. And if it does miss us, then the electronic exchange between the two planets is going to be horrendous. And we're having kind of a philosophical discussion down in the virtual studio tonight. I have a good friend, Return Guidebook, is down in the studio, and we're discussing the fact of the ancients knowing what was going on. How did they know? How could they write in the Old Testament items and accuracies that are so spot on? It is scary. How can that be? How did Nostradamus look into a pool of water and see the atrocities that he wrote of? How can that be? Is it possible that these are abilities that we all have, and only a few have managed to hold on to that special ability? Or is it some wisdom that's coming from elsewhere? And that's the problem we face, is we hear of those elsewheres. And we hear of our good friend David Baker, who speaks to passed on spirits and helps them and helps the loved ones that are left behind. Will we finally get to see them? If Nibiru, Planet X, is not a cataclysmic event for the Earth, then it is, as John Hogue has reported it to be, a changing time, a time of enlightenment and a time of knowing. And if we can get to that time of knowing, then it is quite possible we might actually have peace on Earth. However, I won't be holding my breath for that, not anytime soon, not even with the second coming of Christ, or the Magi, or anything else you want to call it. Well, this week the Calgary Stampede is upon us here in Calgary. Those who are familiar with Calgary, or those who usually follow the show on Archive Download, we are in 4 days into the Calgary Stampede, the greatest outdoor show on Earth. The yearly event got underway on Friday with over 200 float parade, marking a 98 years since the first stampede in 1912. In the years since, the annual festival has grown to attract as many as 1.2 million attendees to its unique mix of concerts, midway rides, and rodeo competitions, featuring approximately $2 million in prizes. And the parties, Oh, yes, the parties. Open beer gardens, saloon girls, and real as well as urban cowboys, daytime music stages and performers, and of course, dozens of daily free pancake breakfasts. Throughout the city, pancakes, Canadian maple syrup, Canadian sausages and crispy Canadian bacon, and campfire Canadian coffee. Although, I gotta tell you, I still prefer Timmy's. Oh, yummy, yum, yum, the Calgary Stampede is truly the greatest show on earth. You know, some people spend 10 days vacationing here, visiting various free pancake breakfasts hosted all around town by the merchants. And then they hit the Stampede grounds for a day, and then end up in the evening in the wee hours at some cowboy party somewhere, hosted by other various merchants. Others, they enjoy the heritage and history of the Wild Wild West, known as the Calgary, Alberta, with a world-class Glenbow Museum and a huge downtown convention center nestled within historic buildings. The ghost tours of downtown are legendary. So Google Calgary Stampede. Make it a point of coming next year for your vacation, and I can assure you that breakfast is on us. Now there, I've done my public service announcement like a good little Canadian soldier should. Can we get on with it now? And we are back with Andy Lloyd. And we're going to be talking about some more Planet X. And we're just waiting for Network to come back. And there we go. Andy Lloyd, author of a number of books, The Dark Star, The Planet X Evidence, Ezekiel 1, a novel based upon Planet X conspiracies of 2012, and The Followers of Horus, where Andy introduces the Anunnaki to the mix. So, Andy, obviously the information and research required to produce such work, it has to be a labor of love.
I got into this in the late 1990s, and I was very taken with a lot of UFO books and the work of people who were looking into sort of ancient history and trying to understand whether there was alternative history going on. And I've always enjoyed reading those, so yes, it is a labor of love. I find it thoroughly enjoyable. I'm fascinated by the entire subject. And why I got, you know, I've worked with David and Martin on Cosmic Conspiracies, who produced this very, very big website towards the beginning of the new century. The Dark Star Theory sort of came out of that as a sort of an offshoot because I wanted to explore this idea of this brown dwarf. I enjoyed reading Mr. Sitchin's work, but I had a big problem with the idea that a planet that developed and evolved in the same way as us.
Right.
So I put forward this idea that that there had to be a sort of a system out there with this dark star, and Nibiru had to be a planet that would orbit the dark star, and in the same way that Jupiter's moons are warmed up by Jupiter, and that mechanism would work in deep space as well and produce a sort of habitable world. And the science of that works, which I'm very happy with.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with it is that, if there is indeed a problem with it, is that obviously when you're talking about a brown dwarf, or a sub-brown dwarf, you're talking about a sort of Jupiter-sized planet,
right,
which arguably is much more difficult to miss than a terrestrial world that's at a very, very extreme distance. So, but I think having spent years exploring the science of this, it's become clear to me that the outer solar system, to a great extent, is like is a total mystery. And I've used the analogy before, which is very useful, that if you imagine your garden, a very long garden that you've got at night time, it's pitch black outside,
mm-hmm,
and you are sitting at your window looking out into the garden, and there's a light in behind you that's sort of shining from the window, and you peer out into the darkness. The patio in front of you, you could see little things on the patio, and if you imagine that being sort of the solar system where we live, you might be able to see the planets being on the patio, if you see
right.
what I mean.
Yep, yep.
But the darkness beyond, nothing in the garden is lit sufficiently by the light from your window, and it's just plunged into darkness. So that's the outer solar system, and beyond the current planet, much beyond there, we know practically nothing about the outer solar system. And the understanding that we all have, that astronomers understand everything about the solar system, is, well, astronomers don't believe that, but people have this feeling that's the case. So my work challenges that and says there's a lot to learn out there. This planet could well be out there. And, you know, as we were saying before, within a couple of years, the evidence could well come forward to substantiate that such a body exists.
There's not much question at all, but there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all. No, for sure we're not alone. Now, life-bearing planet, I happen to be privileged enough to have be in on the fact that we have been visited on this planet, and the UFO phenomenon is real, although it's been covered up by our governments for quite a long time.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com.
And it is being covered up by the governments. It is obvious the governments know a heck of a lot more than they are saying about what's going on out there in the universe. There's a lot of eyes out in the sky. But Marshall Masters had mentioned to me some months ago, and I hadn't given it much thought until recently, but he mentioned that most of our astronomy is done directly above us, if you understand what I'm saying. And we rely on other areas of the globe to give us their astronomy and the likes. So the least amount of telescopic work or the least amount of scientific progress has been made from the southern portion of our Earth. And this is theorized why we have not seen Planet X, because it is coming in through a southern direction. Now, if that's true or false, only time will tell. And as we've been speaking down in the virtual studio, there are many possible outcomes if Planet X exists or not. The outcomes are endless, but the final goal, I would hope, is we will either scare ourselves into peace, or we will destroy ourselves into peace. I think it will be a golden age and an opportunity to finally take the trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars from the military hardware and turn it into something good. But that's just me. So, you know, I don't know where to take it other than that. Reality Bites. When you wrote the book and you considered sending this spacecraft secretly to rendezvous with Nibiru, did you ever consider alternate powers of being able to get through that distance? Or is this based on technology of, say, mid-90s? Would that be a fair request?
That is an absolutely brilliant question, because if you could look at it, as you say, entirely two ways. One of them is you look at the what's available to us, which is effectively just advanced rocket propulsion,
right,
and try and understand how we would send men on a long-distance flight. Now, the main problem, well, there's several huge problems involved. And, of course, there's a lot of discussion about going to the moon and going to Mars, which NASA has thought about and think about and then do a little bit of work on and then realize it's beyond them. Part of the problem is how people survive physically and psychologically for a long period of time in space, which is one of the themes I explore in the book, and the way they have to keep themselves physically and mentally up together, and how that actually is just pie in the sky, because people are people and things just kind of disintegrate. So that's one of the things I explore. In terms of propulsion, a rocket really isn't going to do it. And you're talking about sending however big a spaceship you want, but you're sending it out beyond Neptune and out towards the, you know, interstellar space, really.
Yeah.
Then you need to have a different propulsion system. So what I chose to do is have an idea that Stanton Friedman talked about, and he's a great Canadian, isn't he?
Mm, very much.
Friedman. And in one of his recent books, he describes how there is this sort of myth generated by debunkers that says that aliens could not visit our world because there is simply not a sort of available technology to transfer a spaceship through sort of light years distance. And he says, well, that's just simply bunk, because if you take nuclear powers, nuclear fission, and you create a drive from that, effectively what you're doing is by you can fire out from this sort of fissible material, you can fire out the exhaust coming out of the back of the spaceship, is the sort of the byproducts of the fissionable material, and they're ejected at such sort of speed that it creates a significant force that over time, because the spaceship is not slowed by anything at all in space, over time you can gradually accelerate to immense speed. So I've taken his idea and I've sort of taken that to heart and tried to imagine a spaceship that's going forward for half of the voyage, gradually accelerating up to sort of mind-blown speeds. And then in order to be able to arrive at its destination, it has to kind of flip over halfway through the journey and then sort of slam the brakes on in exactly the same way.
Kind of a slide into home base.
Exactly. And so this space journey that I've sort of produced in the book sort of runs for 15 years, 7.5 of which is slowly accelerating,
right,
and the other 7.5 is slowly decelerating.
Right.
So that sort of creates the context of the book. Now, you're perfectly right. What I could have done would be to sort of go into sort of a whole Roswell thing and say, well, if you back-engineered a crashed saucer, right, and you looked at the sort of anti-gravity propulsion or whatever it is that runs those things,
right,
and then engineered something from that in Area 51 to create some sort of interstellar wormhole light year speed drive thingamajig, then yeah, you get blip, you're where you want to go. But from my point of view, that it almost removes the human drama, because it makes it just so easy in a Star Trek way to just sort of say, right, warp speed, Scotty.
And probably take away those fallible elements of human that make up the story in itself.
And in Moscow recently, and I'm sure you've probably come across this, Colin, but they took about six guys, I think, and they put them in this bunker down in the bottom of a warehouse.
Yeah.
Sealed them up and said, right, in 18 months' time, we're going to come and get you out. And they're seeing how they sort of psychologically cope with living in this sort of enclosed environment, recycling.
Right.
But I have also, in the Followers of Horus, introduced the sort of Roswell thing where you've got...
Right.
But I have also, in the Followers of Horus, introduced the sort of Roswell thing where you've got these flying saucers, and I'm not going to tell you why, because I want people to read it and hear about it, but I do introduce into the story these sudden ships that suddenly start about and are driven about by someone else and make everyone go, oh my goodness, what's going on here?
Right.
So I kind of brought that into it, and it's almost like you've got this very slow, very, very antiquated ship flying out from Earth to this Nibiru, and suddenly they get, they come across these darting around UFOs, kind of looking at them like they're watching the Titanic. I find that kind of a funny concept, really.
Yeah, and I think so too. I mean, we have barely found a method of escaping Earth's gravity. Famed or supposedly made it to the moon and back. We've got rovers on Mars, but we as mankind have spent a great deal of effort trying to break the gravitational boundaries of Earth, and I think we are the Henry Fords of the space industry.
You can have any color you want as long as it's black.
Exactly. I think we're so basic in our thinking, and if there are species out there in our in the outer space and in the universe, which according to mathematicians just positively has to be. We cannot be the only species in this great void. It is almost mathematically impossible. So
it would also be extremely dull.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, the everything about the world in which we live has a thriving life, biodiversity. You know, you go from one country, one continent to another, and all the life different. The oceans are teeming with varied life, and the evolution brings all these different forms down the ages. Well, how on earth can the rest of the universe not be exactly like that?
Exactly.
And the only thing that prevents us from finding out is obviously the vast distances. We're, you know, stuck in this little bubble floating around in the middle of nowhere, and we're incapable, unfortunately, of seeing the vast variety of life, because I'm quite convinced that life is seeded here, it's been brought here by comets, that that the structural DNA is something that's evolved in the universe long, long, long before the sun ever came into existence.
Right.
And you know, the sun just kind of popped into existence through, you know, the physical sort of the dust from the supernovas, and then this visitation of these interstellar comets would bring life here and get it all going again, like a great cycle, a recycling cycle. Life's everywhere, and it's something to be celebrated, but we're unfortunately just not able to see it right now.
Well, and time and space being the killer, because that is what is preventing us from exploration, is the fact of the distance between, you know, what could be a habitable planet of any kind of consequence would be two or three or maybe even four lifetimes before we would actually get there. So I agree with you. The time and space continuum is the key. And if you believe in Einstein's theories and the theories of others, you know, there is a method, they believe, of some kind of travel that doesn't involve the lineage of A to B. So, you know, will it be in our lifetime? I doubt it, Andy. But do you think the government is out there actively investigating these types of possibilities? Do you think there's research, you know, wet ops, black ops, or dark ops?
It was very clear that they certainly were at one point. Now, during the Cold War, the UFO subject was clearly something that the FBI it's just a matter of record. They were fascinated by the subject in the same way that many members of the public were fascinated by it, and they were quite worried about it as well. Ufology field from sort of 47 onwards is full of sort of intervention by government and through various agencies, and there was clearly a cover-up going on of quite a large proportion. Now, what the nature of the UFOs were, I think, is still an open question. And, you know, personally, I think the extraterrestrial hypothesis is the likely answer. But it may be interdimensional. It may be that, it may even be that there's some sort of source to do with our own planet. But Dark Star Theory, they can Google Andy Lloyd. They'll find me. I'm almost also an artist. They'll be able to see my paintings online as well. So Andy Lloyd, Google me. And my books are available in Amazon in the UK, in USA, Canada, and in Europe. And my publisher is Timeless Voyager Press.
Fabulous, Andy. Andy, it's been an absolute pleasure, sir. I do appreciate you being with us tonight.
Thank you so much, Colin. I've really enjoyed the opportunity. You've been fantastic to talk with.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com.
Hey, Night Zoners, got a minute? I'm sure we all know someone who is experiencing difficult times during this recession, either with unemployment or financial problems, or in relationships. I have friends like that. I would like to remind you that we are all in this together. So if you have friends experiencing hardships, support them with your advice. If you have acquaintances who are having rough times, nurture them with your friendship. Show them kindness. If you have family members who are having difficulties, show them your love. And if you have people in your life who have almost given up, throw them a lifeline of kindness. Remember the golden rule, but for the grace of God, go I. Blessings upon your household. Until then, next time we meet.
This has been a Night Zone production in association with BlogTalkRadio.com.
And don't forget, next week we've got Freddie Silva, an expert in crop circles. Make sure you tune in Tuesday, July the 20th, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. It's been a blast. Until next time. Thank you.
Bob, 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 B